For more than two decades, Carl Hiaasen's barbed humor has graced a column in the Miami Herald and now 11 novels. But in September, his sarcastic send-up of the Herald's part in a scandal over government-paid reporters ignited controversy at the paper and around the country. Jesus Diaz Jr., the Miami Herald's publisher, pulled the column in response. Hiaasen offered his resignation. Ultimately, the column ran, and Diaz left the Herald. When not staring down controversy, Hiaasen catalogs Florida absurdities in his novels. The latest, Nature Girl, was published this Tuesday. Later in this hour, we'll remember one of America's most influential economists. Nobel Prize winner Milton Friedman died earlier today. But first, if you have questions for Carl Hiaasen about the controversy over his column, the future of newspapers, or about his books, give us a call. The number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. Carl Hiaasen is here with us in Studio 3A. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Yeah, it's nice to meet you, too. Thanks for having me.
This column set off a firestorm. Did you expect to? Tell us, first of all, what it was about.
Well, it was the whole thing was pretty silly. There were several journalists that worked for El Nuevo Herald, which is the Spanish-language edition of the Herald. There were a couple of them that, it had been revealed in our own paper, had been working on sort of on the side or moonlighting for Radio Martí and TV Martí, which are the U.S. government propaganda networks that allegedly or try to broadcast into Cuba. Most of the signals are jammed. Very few people outside of Washington, D.C. ever get to see TV Martí, and only then in one studio. Mm-hmm. So it's been somewhat of a boondoggle, and I've written about it in the past. But obviously in South Florida, where we have a large Cuban-American community that's very anti-Castro, these are important things. Well, the idea of working for the government while at the same time for a newspaper is really not too cool. I mean, it's not something most journalists wouldn't do it, but there was some issues about whether the editors knew, whether it was on the side, whatever mm-hmm. it was. The journalists were fired, and there was a lot of flack at the time about it. And I had written a column saying, gosh, you know, I've been writing about Castro literally for 30 years, and where's my check? You know, where's my, you know, Uncle Sam never sent me. It was fairly innocuous, I thought, and it mentioned what had happened, and it mentioned the role that our publisher had taken in firing him. And I didn't know at the time, I guess he was already sort of regretting or at least shrinking back from that position. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what, but in any case, he decided that the column was just going to continue to stir things up in the community, and he passed along through my editor the view that it was going to be yanked. And just to correct something, it was never yanked. I mean, it was supposed to run on a Sunday, and it ran on the Sunday. But mm-hmm. what happened? I couldn't believe it. I said, why are you yanked? Oh, because, you know, we've already had 1,100 cancellations. And I said, well, not from my column, A and B. Who cares if it is from my column? That's a problem for the circulation department. It's not a problem for the opinion writers and the columnists and the people that put out the newspaper. And he said, I'm sorry, I can't. Okay, I said, fine, and you can have my resignation. But I hung up, and I was understandably pretty ticked off about mm-hmm. it because this has never happened. And I've been writing the column since 85, and I've been at the paper since 76. And so I made a few calls. McClatchy, it was a company that just bought Knight Ridder, and among the properties it had decided to keep was the Miami Herald, which has won a lot of Pulitzer Prizes. It's a big, important, aggressive newspaper. And I had just had a feeling the folks running McClatchy had no idea this kind of nonsense was going on in our newsroom. And I called a couple of people who I knew, and I said, look, you're going to read about this when I'm gone, and I want you to know what really happened. And I told them, and I mm-hmm. said, it's nothing to do with McClatchy. This has to do with some very bad policy that's being imposed here, and it's a very bad precedent. And they said, don't do anything. You're absolutely right. And they basically, I guess somebody made some phone calls, and next thing I know, I get a call saying the column's running. We're very sorry. We made a big mistake. So I'd let it drop, and then the publisher left shortly thereafter. I wasn't sure why, but I started getting calls from, and I sort of told what happened, and then it turns out, I guess this was a factor in his decision to leave. I think maybe he had a misimpression about what the role of a publisher is, but one of the roles that they shouldn't have is killing columns just because they don't happen to agree with them.
Mm-hmm. Let's get a caller in on the line. This is Eric. Eric's calling us from Athens, Ohio.
Yeah, I was wondering if you questioned the there was nothing slanderous, I suppose, legally in your column and your freedom of press. Did you ever express the views that you know you write to Free Voice?
Well, in the strongest possible terms, my job is to write an opinion column, and that means you take a side. And whenever you take one side, you're going to irritate somebody on the other side. If that doesn't happen, you're not doing your job. That wasn't anything new. We publish many different points of view in the Herald, many contrary to my own, and my own are often contrary with that of the editorial writers. So this was nothing new. It was the surprising thing was that, oh, we're just not going to run the column. We're afraid of losing more subscriptions, which is baloney. And I expressed it in the strongest terms. I didn't feel like I had to be educating people as to the principles of journalism in my own my own news operation. And I said this is just a sad day. It's a sad day for this newspaper when we're editing out of fear and paranoia and concern over whether we're going to ruffle somebody's feathers.
Capitalism came in conflict with.
Well, one of the things I'd read is actually that there was a different perception at these two papers. You talked about the Spanish language edition of the Herald. It's a lot more than that. It's a very opinionated paper.
It is, and especially when it comes to Castro. And no one's certainly ever reined them in and their writers about what they believe to be is best for Cuba.
And they wouldn't have seen a conflict of interest necessarily in railing against Castro on Radio Martí as they would in their newspaper.
Possibly not. It's taking the paycheck that it's the problem. Either you work for the government or you work for a newspaper, but you generally don't do both. The whole concept of a free and independent press in this country is that you speak unfettered and unbeholden to anybody, and you're free to criticize the government, not shill for them.
And as an American vet, I would encourage you to. That's part of what I defended. You know, I'm an infantry vet. I did 5 years. Freedom of press and diplomacy through media is part of what soldier not have to face bullets.
Right.
And so I applaud you. I'm going to let go with this. And I hope things work out well for you.
Thanks so much. Thanks for calling.
Newspapers have not had a happy time of it past few years. Do you think this is an example of the kind of trouble you get in when that kind of economic pressure is piled on you? As you said, this was just sold to from its longtime owner to another group.
I think that's part of it, but there's always been this battle between the business side of the newspapers and the side that puts out the news, and over money, over what we're running. I mean, I've written columns that have criticized big advertisers in the Miami Herald, and they pull their ads, and it cost the paper a great deal of money. The columns were never spiked. They didn't have to change a word in them. This is just, it's been going on since there was newspapers. I don't think it's anything new, and I don't think it reflects on the economic problems of newspapers. Certainly, circulation is down, ad rates are down, penetration is down, all that's down. But the fact of the matter is newspapers still make a ton of money. And what's happened is that if they're not making the 23 or 24% that some of the big companies are making on Wall Street, that's a huge profit. And it's down from that. But they're not losing money. They're just not making the same tonnage of money that they were making a couple years ago. So the big lie is that newspapers are in deep financial trouble. No, the corporations that are selling the stock shares have some concerns, but the people in the community are still generally well served by their newspapers and should be, and that should be the primary role of a newspaper is to put information into people's hands, not to please the shareholders.
Let's see if we get another caller on the line, and this is Mira in Livingston, Montana.
Yeah, that's me. I have a question for your guest, and that's in this growing age of propaganda where the entertainment line and the news line are becoming infused into one, does your guest have any solutions to the problem, and does it have anything to do with our schooling and our ethics in journalism these days?
Well, I mean, I think the solution is good editors, good strong editors who know the difference between what's news and what's hype and what's propaganda. I think what you're referring to is the preponderance of infotainment or entertainment stories that you see in regular newspapers now.
One or two may have creeped onto television too.
Well, exactly, in the broadcast media as well. We'll know far more words will be written and read about Britney Spears' divorce than about, sadly enough, the internal battle for control of the democratic process in Iraq. If you stopped 100 people on the street, 99 of them probably already know that Britney Spears is getting divorced. This is just our culture and our time. It's not intellectually uplifting to consider that, but that's a fact. You have good editors, and you should have them, who just say this doesn't go in the paper, this doesn't go on the nightly news. We'll put some news there instead, and that's what it comes down to. I don't think it's anything to do with the kids, except to the extent that you can sort of monitor what your kids are watching, whether it's on the internet or the iPod or the television. I mean, as a parent, if you want brain dead kids, just set them down in front of the TV and turn it on for about 12 hours, and you'll have a nice, docile little zombie at the end of the day.
It seems like, but what's happening though on television is trickling down into the newspapers. I mean, I see it all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like this big mirror. And what are the solutions to stop this problem that we have in America, which is worse now than I've ever seen it?
Well, I agree with you that a lot of silliness gets in the newspaper, the supposedly serious newspapers now that are trying to be more and more like the. This is part of their desperation because they feel they're losing readers, and so. So the solution is to imitate the absolute worst aspects of the other media culture, and that is let's throw all this garbage into the paper. Every rumor gets into print, no matter how far-fetched or unproven it happens to be. It's just following the herd, and again, it comes down to some good, smart editing where you just make a decision. No, we're not really going to insult our readers' intelligence with this garbage, and you know, the answer is to fight back and to write letters to the paper and say, why are you printing this? I mean, believe it or not, editors and newspaper people listen to the letters they get. They're very sensitive. When readers start complaining about something, somebody will have a meeting somewhere and say, gee, they don't like this. Maybe we should change it. It's the truth. And networks are the same, especially networks are the same way.
Mira, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
One quick question more about this incident, then we'll go to a break and come back and talk about your novel. But the three reporters who were fired and six others who I think were later implicated in doing the same kind of thing, maybe not on the same scale, working for Radio Marti at the same time as they were working as journalists in Miami, were rehired.
Well, there was an amnesty issue, let's put it that way. And the ones, keep in mind, only a couple of these were full-time employees. Some were freelancers. And you have a real question there. If you can control a freelancer, A, and B, what kind of rules and instructions has the freelancer been given? I was more concerned, and everybody in the newsroom was, with about staff members. Now, they were rehired because it was very vague about what their bosses knew, and if their bosses winked and said, hey, it's okay, you can't very well fire them.
Yeah.
But it was never nailed down.
Well, Carl Hyacin will be talking about fun things like greed and Florida when we come back from a short break. I'm Neil Cunn, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Our guest today is Carl Hyacin, a columnist with the Miami Herald and the author of 11 novels. The most recent is called Nature Girl. You can read an excerpt from the book at our website, the Talk of the Nation page at npr.org. If you have questions for Carl Hyacin about his novels, give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, our email address, talk@npr.org. And would you do us a favor of reading a little bit from Nature Girl?
Okay, I guess should I set this up a little bit?
A little bit, if you want.
Yeah, all right. This is the one of the characters in the novel is a half-blooded Seminole Indian, and his father died in kind of a tragic way, and resulting in Sammy being sent back to the reservation during adolescence. And this is just a brief description of what happened to his old man, who was a well-meaning guy and just sort of in the wrong place at the wrong time. Cecil McQueen died in a chokehold at a nightclub called Le Lube, where he and six friends had gone for a bachelor party. The branch supervisor of the trucking firm was being married the next day to his ex-wife's divorce accountant, and his buddies couldn't decide if it was a master stroke or an act of self-destruction. At the strip joint, the men drank festively but set no records. Normally a shy person, Cecil McQueen surprised his companions when he bounded into the mud wrestling pit to take on a dancer known as Big Satin, who outweighed him by 53 pounds and was unaware, as was Cecil, of his obstructed cardiac arteries. Afterwards, Big Satin felt terrible. So did Cecil's co-workers and supervisor, although the wedding went on as scheduled. The police ruled the death as accidental, but nonetheless it dominated the TV news, which was how the victim's only son, then addressed as Chad, learned that his father had not perished while rescuing a vanload of orphans from a flooded drainage canal. That was the yarn his stepmother had cooked up.
Rescuing the van load of orphans. That's a nice touch. You see, similarly, your colleague at the Miami Herald, you can't make this stuff up. A lot of this stuff is based on real life, isn't it?
Well, you sort of clip stuff out every day, and you have clippings sent to you every mm-hmm. day from around Florida that are so bizarre. They go into a file, and sometimes it's gathering string, and you just got to figure out a way to work it in to a book in a way that people will, you know, stop and their jaws drop later, and they'll say, "How did you make this up?" And you pull out the clipping and you say, I didn't make it up. No.
Let's get some listeners involved in the line. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us. Email us talk@npr.org. And we'll start with Molly. Molly calling us from Canton in Michigan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm 14, and I just wanted to tell Mr. Hyacin that I really enjoy all of your books, and I was reading when I was in third or fourth grade, and it's actually made me consider a career as an environmentalist or an environmental lawyer. So thank you very much, and please don't stop writing about controversial topics.
I won't, and you made my whole afternoon by saying that. Thank you for mentioning the book, and I'm glad it had that effect on you. I've gotten so much mail from kids, and it's been the most surprising thing I think I've ever done as a writer. That when I wrote these two, I wrote two novels for, mm-hmm. for young adults, and the response was beyond anything I could have imagined. And it's phone calls like yours that make me realize there is hope for the world. And I hope you become a great environmental lawyer because we need them.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks for calling. Bye.
Thanks, Molly. Let's go now to Richard. Richard's with us from Jacksonville, Florida.
Yeah, so I'd like to first say that I'm a great admirer of Mr. Hyacin's books, and I'm looking forward to reading his new one. And I wanted to ask him if he ever considered basing any of his novels around North Florida. the themes resonate of development and the environment, and some of the things that happen a lot in South Florida are beginning to really take hold in North Florida. And it seems like the culture of the good old boy culture and some of the other things would really lend themselves to a Carl Hyacin book based a little further north of Florida.
Yeah, I get some weird mail weird clippings from the Jacksonville paper, from the Times Union and things. So you're right. The culture of creepiness has moved upstate. South Florida used to sort of have a monopoly on it, but the stuff is happening in Tampa and Jacksonville that will absolutely, you know, appall any civilized person. I read it. And also, that's a very beautiful area up there. And you're right. There's huge battles going on for what, especially the St. John's River area now. The state of Florida, in its wisdom, has decided that it's okay to dump more stuff in there, that it can't get much worse than it is, I guess. And so they've decided that a little more pollution won't hurt the St. John's River.
They actually tried to make the argument that it would actually make it better.
So. Yeah. Yeah, it's unbelievable. So, but now we have a new governor, and it's possible he may listen a little closer to some of your concerns. But thank you so much for calling.
Thank you.
Richard, thanks. Do you get calls from other states? Couldn't you move to Colorado?
All the time. I get letters all the time. If I'm on a book tour nationally, almost everywhere mm-hmm. I go, somebody comes up and presses a newspaper clipping into my hand or something off the internet and says, if you read this, you'll want to move here because this is going on and you got to help us. And I think, one of the things I never realized, that I always thought this Florida was the battleground. I mean, it is a battleground, but it's happening all over the place. Wherever you have some beautiful natural resources, somebody is trying to subdivide it.
This book sets out a character who was in response to the importunings of callers at night, people asking her to buy various things. A couple of people from Texas decides to take them on a tour of the Everglades.
Yeah, she's the main character's name in Nature Girl. Her name is Honey Santana, and she's a single mom, and she gets one of these telephone solicitors and calling her right at the dinner hour, and she has somewhat of a short fuse and a long memory, and so she decides, after a very unpleasant conversation with this fellow, that she's going to do what all of us have fantasized about doing, and she's going to track the guy down, she's going to call him at dinner at his house, mm-hmm. and she's going to take it one step further and sell him something he really doesn't need or won't want. And what she does is she finds him through a lot of trickery and guile. She finds the guy and sells him on a sort of a bogus Florida vacation. He thinks he's coming down for rum drinks and Jimmy Buffett music, and he's really coming down to the 10,000 Islands, which is one of the more harrowing vacations he will ever have.
Let's get some more listeners on the line. This is David. David's with us from Point Reyes Station in California.
Oh, it's beautiful.
Hey, Carl. It's really nice to talk to you. I've just discovered you. I've just been working my way through your books, really enjoying them, recommending them to all my friends. And I have there's one character who keeps showing up in lots of your books named Skink, mm-hmm. this mythical maybe ex-governor of Florida who quit. And then went on to become this radical environmentalist and wild man. And I want to know, is he based on reality? What's up with that?
I wish he were, David. He's a character that one of the characters I wish was based on somebody real. He's not. We could use him down there. He was an invention. He first popped up in a book I wrote called Double Whammy, which was about sex, murder, and corruption on the professional bass fishing circuit. It was a very literary landscape for me to visit. And Skink, I just needed a hermit guy, and I sort of invented him. He's a Vietnam vet, ran for office, won, got up to Tallahassee and realized how corrupt and abominable it was, and just ran, one day stripped off his clothes and ran screaming into the woods. And he comes out, he lives off roadkill, and he comes out occasionally when I need him in certain books. And I believe it or not, I've had former governors of Florida suggest to me that they were the model for this character, which suggests a detachment from reality that is not uncommon with politicians.
An emailer named Charles has David's follow-up question. What has Skink been up to?
People have been asking me that. He's not in this novel. I did that on purpose because he sort of takes over when he's there. And now he's getting older. He appeared briefly and effectively in a book called Skinny Dip that I did a couple years ago. And right now he's resting. He's infirm. He's getting to that age where men get where you have a lot of problems you really don't want to talk about with people. And he's crankier. And I've just got to figure out the next time when I sort of bring him out of the swamp. And it hasn't happened yet. He'll be back. I just don't know when. Mm-hmm. I have to be careful with him.
Well, this is the rabbit quadrilogy, and I guess Skink is going to be back too.
Yeah, I mean, I don't plan these things, but there are certain moments where no one else will do but him.
Well, I certainly hope that he, your mythical character, actually creates somebody in real life.
It would be nice, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Thanks, David.
Thank you.
So long. Let's go to, this is Inger. Inger in St. Louis, Missouri.
Hi, I had a question for you, Carl. My daughter likes to still be read to, and I was very interested if Hoot would be appropriate to read out loud to her, because I read one of your books and it dealt with retribution, and what I'm understanding is your newest book deals with retribution too, that the bad guys get their just desserts, and I don't really see a lot of movies based upon books because I like to read so well, so I didn't see Hoot the movie.
Uh-huh. Well, I want to make a clear distinction between the books for kids and the grown-up books. The reason I started the books for kids is that I was reluctant to give the grown-up books to the kids in my own family who are 8, 9, 10, 11. I mean, I was reluctant to do it, and I wanted to give them something they could read.
I've read the descriptions of them as adult fiction.
I know. Isn't it bizarre? I read Hoot to my own six-year-old, and he loved the movie as well because he got to go on the movie set. He thought that was cool. But it's perfectly appropriate, and it's taught in classes as young as third grade. So I think it's fine to read to kids. And same with Flush. I mean, there's absolutely nothing in there. But the older novels obviously have some adult situations that I would be hesitant to share with a small child unless you want him to sleep with a nightlight on for the rest of his life. I'm pretty cautious about that. But it's the same sense of humor. It's certainly the same irreverence and the same the same sympathies regarding sort of what we're doing to the planet. All that's there in the books for younger kids.
Thanks, Inger.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Here's an email from Jack. So many of your characters in your books remind me of those in Donald Westbrook's Cops and Robbers books. Did he have any influence on your writing?
Which author?
Donald Westbrook.
Okay. Does he mean Donald Westlake?
I think he must mean Donald Westlake.
Yes. I'm a big fan of his. And He's got a great sense of humor, and he's just an incredibly witty guy. I love his stuff.
Mm-hmm. Has a great ear for dialogue, too, which I think you do. It's obviously different dialogue.
He does, and he's got a great ear for dialogue. He reminds me in many ways of Elmore Leonard in mm-hmm. that sense. He's got that great sense. But I didn't start reading Don Westlake until after I started writing my own books, and other people had recommended him to me. And then I got to meet him at a couple of book events, and now I try to buy everything that he writes as soon as it comes out. Lawrence Block is another one. Larry Block is just very funny and incredibly prolific. I'm jealous of how prolific he is. But he's another one, just got a great ear and social commentary as well mixed in. The way John D. MacDonald used to do it with the Travis McGee series. Then John D. MacDonald was a hero of mine, and I think of a lot of folks who grew up in Florida.
Yeah, and, America, we hate our cars, Travis would go on his rant. let's go to Jim. Jim was with us from Tallahassee.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Hi, Carl. I was wondering if you've ever heard from the Escadas or the Fonhuls.
and who are they, Jim?
They're associated with U.S. Sugar.
Uh-huh. The big sugar.
Writing.
I'll tell you one funny story. When I was in the novel Striptease, the villains in that novel are a family, a very wealthy family that has a big sugar growing corporation in Florida, and they're dumping their pollution into the Everglades. Imagine that. really far-fetched stuff.
Who could make this stuff?
Yeah, after the novel came out, and then there was talk that the movie was going to be made, I was contacted by someone who works for the Fonhul family, which owns a big sugar outfit down there. And he said, just want to come have a friendly talk. And he's a very nice guy. And he came down to the Keys where I was living at the time, and we had a talk. And he goes, I just was curious. Was the Rojo family in the novel, you know, the people are saying it's based on the Fonhuls. You wouldn't do that, would you? And I said, George, of course I wouldn't. What makes you think I would do something like that? And I said, that's all in your imagination. And I needled him, and I wondered if he was having a little guilty conscience. I told him, I've got enough villains to worry about in my books. I don't need to borrow from you guys. But then he encouraged me to come up to the Clewiston and look at the sugar, the sugar mill, and see how cleanly they chop and burn down hundreds of thousands of acres of sugar cane. And I just haven't found the time to do it for some reason. It hasn't worked into my schedule.
Jim, thanks very much for the call.
Well, you're welcome. I grew up in Miami, and my family was worked for the Miami News for many years.
That was a great newspaper. I wish it was still around.
Bill Bagg's wife was my first grade teacher.
No kidding. Right. Yeah, we'd be a better town if we had two papers, I'll tell you.
So long, Jim.
Thank you, Carl. Bye-bye.
We're talking today with Carl Hiaasen. His new book is Nature Girl. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go to Bob. Bob with us from Memphis.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air, Bob. Go ahead, please.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. My family's from Fort Lauderdale, and we have a vacation home down in Isla Mirada. We've done a lot of fishing down there, and I was just curious to hear what Mr. Hiaasen has to say about what he writes about fishing in his books a lot, and just what about it captivates him and just intrigues him so much.
Well, I'm also from Fort Lauderdale, and I also spent a lot of time in the Keys, and I still have a place in Isla Mirada. Go down there a lot. It was just the thing that struck me as a kid, and I think it growing up at a time when it wasn't so crowded, is you could just be in a boat for 10 minutes and be so far away from civilization and be looking at Florida exactly as it must have looked thousands of years ago, especially in the back country of the Everglades and Florida Bay and out by Flamingo and those places. And there's still sort of magical spots you can go to and get away. But the solitude of it and the fact that this incredible marine life everywhere in that shallow water, it's literally like being in an aquarium with the stingrays and the dolphins and manatees and the turtles and all of it. If you're not from Florida, sounds, you know, wild and unimaginable, but if you grew up around that sort of beauty, you do get addicted to it, and it's also what makes you want to fight for it when you see it start to disappear, and you see pollution start to creep in, and the algae blooms, and you see the fish start to die, and the dolphins move away. I mean, a lot of that is what sort of fuels the anger in the satire, and that's where satire comes from. That's where satirical humor comes from, is a sense of anger and outrage, and a lot of that's from seeing those things change in my lifetime. But it's just, it's so peaceful and tranquil. I think people, if you talk to people from the West, Montana, Colorado, places like, they'll tell you the same thing. There's nothing like being on fly fishing in a stream out there in Western Montana all by yourself, just you and the river. It's a pretty special experience.
Thanks, Bob.
All right, thank you very much.
And we just have a few seconds left, but your next book, might it be about people who don't broadcast from anywhere and take money from the government?
No. You know what? There's some things that sort of surpass and defy satire. I have no idea what the next book's going to be. The next one I'm starting will be another book for kids, though, for young readers. And I have no idea the title, anything else. It'll come to me in a flash, I hope.
Carl Hyacin, thanks very much for coming in. Good luck with your book.
Thanks for having me here.
The new book is Nature Girl, just came out this week. Carl Hyacin, not only a novelist and author for young people, but a columnist for the Miami Herald. When we come back from a short break, we'll remember the man who championed individual freedom in economics and politics and influenced the policy of at least three U.S. presidents. If you knew Nobel winner Milton Friedman, were a student of his, or followed his work, we'd like to hear from you. Give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or you can send us email, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Cunningham. We'll be back after the break. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.